You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Good afternoon, and thanks for listening to Health Justice Radio on CFMU 93.3. On today's show, we're focusing on the issue of health and homelessness. Later on, we'll be speaking to Dr. Lori Regenstrafe, the medical director of Hamilton's Shelter Health Network. But for now, let's look at some basics. Homelessness is the situation where an individual or family lacks a fixed, regular residence that is of adequate quality, or resides primarily in a supervised public or private night residence intended for temporary shelter, in an institutional setting, or in a private or public space not intended to be used for regular sleeping accommodations. Homelessness can be either absolute, where someone is literally living on the street or in shelters, or it can be relative, where someone is facing eviction and lacks the resources to obtain alternate housing, or lives in housing considered substandard. So why does homelessness occur? According to the report, On Any Given Night, Measuring Homelessness in Hamilton, published by the Social Planning and Research Council, the two major contributors to homelessness are lack of adequate income and lack of adequate affordable housing. Families or individuals may be homeless or at risk of becoming homeless for a number of reasons, including experiencing abuse or violence, losing a job, having an income too low to stay in suitable housing, experiencing food insecurity, suffering from mental or physical health conditions, experiencing discrimination by landlords or neighbors, facing challenges with substance use, lack of appropriate support services, and excessive housing costs. Here in Hamilton, a city with one of the highest poverty rates in Ontario, at 1 in 5 people, the homelessness statistics speak for themselves. The SPRC estimates that the number of people accessing emergency shelters has more than doubled since 1995. On any given night, close to 400 men, women, and children stay in emergency shelters. The social housing waitlist has 4,258 active applications. About 22% of renter households spend more than 50% of their income on shelter, which puts them at serious risk of homelessness. What makes this issue important to health? It is now commonly accepted that housing and health issues are directly related. Evidence shows that people who are homeless experience poorer health and shorter lives. Foot, skin, and dental problems are common among the homeless population. Rates of chronic health conditions, such as cardiovascular and chronic respiratory problems, are much higher than the general population. In a 2004 study on health and homelessness, over one-third of participants reported not having enough energy to get through the day and eating only one meal a day. This is not surprising, given that Hamilton's food banks record an average of 15,000 visits per month. 27% of participants in the study reported not having an Ontario health card. Finally, 24% reported a diagnosis of mental illness. Yet, despite these important health discrepancies, those living with homelessness often do not get adequate health care due to the complexity of their health care needs and the lack of provision of accessible health services. This may be due to a lack of coordination and continuity of health care services across sectors, such as between acute care and community settings, and a lack of integration across health and social services. And this is where the Shelter Health Network comes in. Hamilton's Shelter Health Network aims to provide comprehensive care in the community that is accessible, integrated, and multidisciplinary. It offers continuity, quality, and satisfaction to both clients and providers, and focuses on health promotion, independence, and choice. Established in 2005, the Shelter Health Network is a collaboration of healthcare professionals and social services organizations working to provide services to those with unstable housing and complex health problems. To give us a better idea of this innovative organization, we talked to Dr. Lori Regenstrafe, medical director of the Shelter Health Network. We reached her by phone in Hamilton.
Can you tell us what the mandate of a Shelter Health Network is? Well, I guess you would say the mandate is through community partnerships. Our goal is to improve access and provide primary care to marginalized populations, primarily of individuals experiencing homelessness. And we've been doing this since about 2005, 2006.
Okay, and what is your role within the Shelter Health Network?
My personal role?
Yes.
Myself? I'm the lead physician. So, first of all, the Shelter Health Network, on one hand, is simply a contract between a group of physicians and the ministry. The ministry, about 6 years ago, or 5 years ago, agreed to pay physicians to provide primary care in the shelters. They left it to us to figure out how to do that. What they simply said was, we will give you 3.5 full-time equivalents, 3.0 of family docs, and 0.5 of specialist hours per week to provide that care, and we'll leave it entirely to you to figure out how to do that.
Okay.
So we were already at the table with all of the shelters in Hamilton, which you may be familiar with. They're all faith-based agencies.
Okay.
So completely different approach to what many people are familiar with in terms of interacting with healthcare providers. They're really so community social service agencies. So we were sitting at the table with, Mission Services, Wesley Urban Ministries, Good Shepherd Centers, and Salvation Army, as well with CMHA, Canadian Mental Health Association, with the two hospital organizations, each of whom run one of the detox programs, and Womankind, which is a women's treatment program for substance disorders. And let's see, who else is it? Public Health, who has a mental health outreach team that sees people who are extreme homelessness. So they don't access the shelters, and they tend not to access many services. So they're at the sort of the extreme end of the homelessness spectrum. So we were all sitting at the table very early on trying to figure out how to improve healthcare access for individuals who are very, very marginalized and very impoverished. They have lots of barriers that I can talk about related to that that keep them from being able to get good primary care. So we all sat down and we decided we'd figure out how to do it as we went along, literally, and we made a contract with the ministry to bring in the doctors. They approved our sites. They're usually pretty good about saying, okay, you can add that site. So as shelters change or expand or renovate or move, we're able to move with them and expand with them. And that way we're able to bring the doctors to where the patients are, which makes a huge difference in helping them overcome some of the barriers they have to accessing physicians.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit more about those barriers, what some of the challenges the population you serve faces on a daily basis here in Hamilton?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and they're all related to poverty. That's no surprise. You know, you mentioned housing and food security, employment, health issues, and those each in themselves are barriers. The social determinants of health, which is sort of a catchphrase that's used in teaching and talking about providing health care, are really all very tightly tied to poverty and to people's ability to manage their day-to-day needs with the amount of money they have access to, whether they're employed or not. But primarily the individuals we work with are mainly unemployed for various reasons, or chronically unemployed or transiently employed, and the same goes for their housing. So really, I can't say that there's one barrier that's bigger than another. I could list a number of them. A major one is mental health issues, because people with severe mental health diagnoses tend to be unstable for significant periods of time, and that means either they go off medication that's indicated for their diagnosis, or they may not be able to take it on their own, and they don't have good community supports. They don't have a parent or a spouse or a child that can help them look after their medications, and so they tend to become unstable very quickly. And once that happens, so this is just one example, once that happens, they tend to fall very quickly into the realm of homelessness and end up in the shelters. Those mental health issues would also include addiction issues, which often go along with mental health issues. People will, at some point in their life, usually attempt to self-medicate to try to manage their own symptoms. And then as their ability to access primary care worsens as they get older, then their ability to get help in managing their symptoms gets worse, and sometimes their addictions worsen because of that as well. Other simple things that we don't think about are that many people aren't able to manage a phone number. So they can't manage a landline for a very long time, maybe because they're not consistently housed. They may get a cell phone. People often say, oh, well, that homeless person has a cell phone. But they're paying for it on an as-you-go basis, or they are managing a bill this month that they can't manage next month. Then they lose their phone. And so the phone number they may have given to a physician, or they may have handed it in somewhere important, is no longer valid and they can't be reached. So they become difficult to follow up. That's a huge problem. Just managing to get to appointments, having bus fare, having access. Most people we see, in fact, I'd say 99.5% of them don't have a car or access to a car. Getting somewhere on time can be difficult. A lot of people don't have a means of scheduling, keeping track of schedules, or they may not be mentally stable enough to be able to do that. Those are some of the big ones. And then really sometimes it comes down to prioritizing. So if they have to get food, they have to get a check cashed, they have to get very basic things or get to the food bank, they're not for sure that day going to be able to make an appointment that they previously might have had with a doctor. So all those little things, on top of the fact that many people have had negative experiences, having been homeless, having been in situations maybe with the police or with emergency departments or ambulance drivers where they didn't feel comfortable or they didn't have a great interaction, they're often intimidated or anxious about approaching primary care providers, and usually end up seeing people only when they're very unwell, like in an emergency department, sort of a crisis setting. And so that's what's familiar to them in terms of seeing doctors. They only see them when they're in crisis. So that's not a great kind of relationship or even sense of what it's like to be around physicians. So we try to provide something that's a bit different.
Okay. And can you give us some idea of specifically what kind of services you provide and what kind of approach that you take to address some of these issues with your clients?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have opened up clinics in 15 locations, either in or connected to homeless shelters or community social services in the city. Those clinics have relied very heavily on the agencies that host them to provide space, sometimes a desk, computers, a staff person who can help get people in and out the door, and who's going to go next, and perhaps maybe arranging for an x-ray to be done or a lab result or a lab ordered or something like that. So there's about 20 of us right now. Each of us has our own home site. And then we're to various degrees responsible to that site for the rest of the week as well. So some sites will contact us in between if something comes up with a patient. We try to develop some continuity for individuals so they know they can always see the same doctor when they come to that site. And then if people move from location to location, we have a web-based electronic medical record, which is OSCAR, which is a product of our down-the-road McMaster, the OSCAR electronic medical record. Because it's web-based, multiple providers can access a chart at multiple sites. So somebody can go from, for example, the Salvation Army to the Good Shepherd Centers, see the nurse or the doctor at the Good Shepherd Centers, and they can open up the chart and say, oh, I see, yeah, the allergic reaction you had last week was to amoxicillin. So that's hugely valuable because people are really focused on other things. They can't always keep track of what medication they were given last week or what tests were ordered. We're able to keep it all together in one place. So one of the things that we try to provide is some continuity of care that for many people is very unfamiliar. They've not had that either in their lifetime or not for a long time. Some of the specific examples of services. So the sites and the services, we have some degree of nursing care, getting nursing funding has been a big challenge because the ministry and the lands don't provide a concerted nursing programs to something like what we do. So we've had to apply based on a different location and program. So each of our sites, many of our sites actually have a program linked to it. For example, the Salvation Army has something called the Discharge Vet Program, or actually we call it Hospital to Home. And it's a program that allows the hospital to discharge individuals who don't have a fixed address to the Salvation Army rather than keeping them in hospital longer than they would need to stay there. So they can then come to that site if they need IV treatments or somebody to make sure they take their medication for the rest of the course of their illness. There's a nurse there 24/7. So that site's been funded by the land specifically to provide that service. So we have nurses at that site. We have a managed alcohol site, which is up on the mountain on West 5th, called the Claremont Special Care Unit, Claremont House Special Care Unit, and that's for individuals who have had a long history of at-risk drinking, often what we call non-beverage alcohol, and some of them are palliative. In other words, they're at end-stage liver disease or end-stage alcoholism and the disease related to that, and they can come up there and live up there and receive a regular dosing schedule of alcohol. It's not exactly a bottomless bar. It's simply that they're given enough alcohol to keep them from going into withdrawal, and they can then focus on other needs like getting regular meals, and they have a place to sleep and live, and it becomes a little bit like a long-term care program for them. They have regular doctor's visits, and they can choose to move on to treatment. They can choose to stop drinking. They can choose to continue to drink, and they can even choose to die there by giving advanced directives if they're very unwell and they prefer to stay where they are. Some of them really like to stay around their friends there, and that's a very mixed program. And most of the other programs are primarily either a treatment program or an outpatient program connected to a shelter. So the men's center, women's programs, there's a youth shelter, so quite a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a family center at the Good Shepherd, which serves families who are recent arrivals or suddenly experiencing homelessness, so those will be families with children, and they often have just arrived from another country. They may be refugees or newly arrived immigrants with not all of their supports in place, and the shelters themselves help them to obtain housing. And we'll often see them in follow-up to make sure they get moved into a community practice. That's another thing we try to do, is when people are stabilized and they have gained housing, we try to help them move into a family practice where that's most suitable to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not as difficult as it sounds. We often tell our colleagues that we're actually sending them our best patients.
Dr. Regenstrafe, is there anyone besides those living in the shelters who are actually using the Shelter Health Network services?
I see people with outreach who are living in the streets, like quite literally sometimes in the streets, but we also see people who are either at risk of homelessness, so we know they have chronic mental health issues or physical issues that put them at risk of chronic homelessness, and we tend to keep them in our practice. We also know that there are people who are afraid to access the shelters, and maybe they've had a bad experience, or there's people they're avoiding or whatever, and they tend to be out in the community elsewhere, and we try to make sure that we're accessing them, usually through mental health outreach. So if somebody suddenly appears under a bridge and somebody knows that they've been sleeping there, they'll call Public Health Hamilton, the City of Hamilton office, and that referral will go through to the outreach team, and that will come to us, and we can then go out and see people and find out why they're in the situation they're in, and the public health outreach team will often help them find housing and do some problem solving around some of their issues. And if they're health related, they'll engage us, the physicians, to see them as well. So it's broader than just people living in shelters, and we do try to look at anyone who's couch surfing technically and unable to maintain stable housing as appropriate patients for us.
I'd like to ask you something more, like a personal reflection. Is there any lessons that you've learned in your role with the Shelter Health Network over the past few years?
Well, you know, I can only speak for myself. There's a number of us that have been involved from the very beginning, and I have to say that we've all learned to appreciate, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I'm sure I could speak for all of us to say that we've all learned to appreciate community partnerships,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of what you think you need or that you don't have is actually there, and that if you create those links in the community, you can make it work very smoothly, much more smoothly than you can do on your own. So the more we silo our service, the less helpful it is. And as long as it's client-centered, so patient-centered, if you look at what does someone need, and you try to think of that as a kind of a unified collection of things, then you probably have somebody in your community who can provide those needs, or a number of different people providing those different needs, and it's simply a matter of being able to make the linkages and help people move through the system better than they have in the past. So that's one thing. The other thing that I think we probably all know intuitively coming into this, but we all have it reinforced, is that a little compassion goes a long way, and a combination of compassion, tolerance, and open-mindedness and flexibility, which I think of them all really, there should be one word that covers all of those qualities, is really important, because if you're able to see each person not as a collection of patients that all have this one label, but rather as individuals, I know you've heard that a million times, but that one person in that room with you at that moment and their needs as being unique for them for that moment, and appreciate what they've been through by listening to their stories, it's incredible how much you're giving them simply by respecting that they have some sometimes very happy and very sad stories. And just giving them that is a huge piece of the health care you're providing. So it's one thing to be able to say, oh, that's okay, that rash is just because of blah, 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 and this will go away, or we can do something about that. If you actually can also appreciate the whole person and the story that came in the room with them, you're actually giving them a huge piece of therapeutic benefit that they may have missed elsewhere just because another physician or a nurse or somebody in an emergency department was rushed, or someone in a walk-in clinic just simply didn't have the time to listen to. Because those, a lot of our healthcare, you know, primary care settings aren't really set up to listen to people's stories. They're set up to manage as many problems as possible within as short a time as possible. And that, in some ways, makes the system more efficient, but in other ways, makes it less efficient on an individual one-to-one basis.
Okay. And from your perspective, what are some of the reactions of your patients to some of the care that you provide? What have been their sort of their feedback to you?
Oh, I think it's probably easy to say that they're very appreciative. We do spoil them a little. I have to point out that because we're paid by the hour. So, I mean, some clinics are very, very busy and they can't help it. Some clinics have the luxury of being able to set up appointments and give people extra time. And I know my patients, they can be storming around in the waiting room wondering why I'm behind, but they know very well that I'm giving extra time to somebody that needs it and that they'll be next and their day will come where they'll need that extra time. And we have that. It's a huge luxury that we're allowed. It can make it a little bit hard to encourage people to move on. I often warn them, well, you're not going to get this kind of time from your new doctor, but it's not their fault. So that they're prepared for the idea that the quality of the care they're getting may be a little bit faster, but it's not necessarily less in terms of, you know, what they can get from a community practice. So that we spoil them a little, but I often, my philosophy is, well, they haven't had enough of this in the past. They deserve a little extra. That's fine.
Well, I mean, that's all the questions I have. It sounds like you guys are doing some really amazing work, and it's been a real pleasure speaking to you today. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, you're very welcome, Shannon. It was nice talking to you.
So that was Dr. Lori Regan-Strafe, the medical director of the Shelter Health Network. If you want any more information about the Shelter Health Network, you can check out their website at www.shelterhealthnetwork.ca. And thanks for joining us today on Health Justice Radio, CFMU 93.3. To ease you into the rest of the afternoon, we'll play some new Canadian music. We've got Basha Bulat with Heart of My Own. Thanks for joining us.
Under that burning ether that falls down on these walls, burning my arms, I've been harmed, but set by you. For every word I could undo, I've been uncrossed and I've been untrue. I've been the thorn, I've been the harm, but the heart of my own, burn it down low. The light in your verse and the shadow between, the way that I was when I used to know. But I go, want to I hold, oh, the maid or the mother I'll be, if only the loom and a thread or a comb. It is what to be, that's an out here, and tomorrow we mend the empty bones. There are roses that come without seeking. They're all the ones that I have to sow. And your verses that I am repeating, the way that I was when I used to know. The way that I once when I used to know.